TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. Technology and Globalization. Biotechnology may change life on Earth forever. Chris Desser and Mei Wan Ho. What are the known and what are the feared consequences of biotechnology, eugenics, and nanotechnology? Under the heading Remaking the Nature of Nature, the International Forum on Globalization brought together a panel of dissenting scientists. You will hear their eloquent reasoning and appeals for a halt to many of the experiments done today. Now you will hear from Mei Wan Ho, professor of biophysics and author of Genetic Engineering, Dream or Nightmare. She reports on the recent accidental creation of a deadly virus that could affect humans. A lab in Australia has produced this potential biowarfare agent in the course of an apparently innocent genetic engineering experiment. They were doing research for smallpox vaccine. Mei Wan Ho is introduced by Chris Desser. She's the director of the Fundus Working Group on Emerging Technologies. Her organization is concerned with the environmental and political impacts of new technologies. Chris Desser gives a brief overview over what she calls a complex interaction of technology, business interests, and state power. Chris Desser.
This panel, Remaking the Nature of Nature, will take a broad look at how emerging technologies, including biotechnology, eugenics, nanotechnology, and robotics, are fast launching us into a post-biological, perhaps even post-human, era. As these new technologies are applied to agriculture, they have unknown and potentially devastating consequences for the environment and for our experience of the wild, natural world. If they're irresponsibly applied to humans and human reproduction, they will forever change the way that we reproduce and alter our very species. Singly and in combination, these technologies threaten the biosphere and the whole human prospect. The new technologies are redirecting evolution away from a predominantly wild process to one that is predominantly artificial, driven by greed rather than natural selection. Further, they render the most fundamental existential questions, like what does it mean to be human, and how do I find meaning in my life, irrelevant. Increasingly, media technologies like the internet are channeling humans into money-spending units. These technological superstructures constrict the boundaries of our experience to serve their own economic ends. Requiring a constant infusion of capital to survive, they channel all human experience into an economic one. Our money is their lifeblood. To hell with questions of meaning and values, we're being programmed to perform a uniquely human function, simply and only to spend money. Not everyone recoils from this future. The Extropians look forward to this new era, which they call the singularity, with millenarian zeal, defined by writer Werner Vinge in 1986 in his book Lex Tropicon, the singularity is, quote, that moment when our self-guided evolutionary development will accelerate enormously, powered by nanotech, neuroscience, artificial intelligence, and uploading, that is, scanning our brains into computers, which will obviate the need for bodies as just so much meat. As scanning and implant technologies develop, the distinction between humans and technology, humans and machines, will disappear. As we reverse engineer human systems and combine that knowledge with miniaturization, we will change the nature of what it means to be human, and these pesky existential questions will just evaporate. In addition to the perfection and longevity promised by human-machine combinations, the human genetic technologies purport to offer new and better ways to create new humans and bring back dead or soon-to-be dead ones. Short of cloning, scientists are hoping to use the discoveries of the Human Genome Project. In the wake of the announcement of the completion of the human genome, however, many scientists are finally saying what others of us have long intuited to be true. that it is delusional to believe that genes alone can ever tell us what it means to be human. As David King has pointed out, if we're 98% genetically identical to chimpanzees, then perhaps there's something more subtle going on. Notwithstanding the end of genetic determinism, biotechnology concerns will continue to patent genes and biological processes. The singularity might obviate the need for money, but the biotech companies are hedging their bets with an unswerving commitment to patenting all forms of life and developing economically promising proprietary products, even as they wreak potentially irrevocable harm, havoc, on the biosphere. The economic gain for the few who own the life they are manipulating has grave consequences for humans and other species. This patenting extends to the knowledge of indigenous peoples and the patenting of the genetic material of discrete populations. Iceland was the first country to sell the rights to the genetic material of its entire current and future populations to a medical biotech corporation. More recently, Tonga did the same thing. The gene giants disregard the impact of their actions on the web of relationship that constitutes our global ecosystem, when in fact, neither they nor we have any idea how altering species and mixing genes in the environment will affect complex ecosystems and evolution. Regarding transgenic plants, Steve Jones, professor of genetics at University College in London, believes that genetic pollution is inevitable, that genes from genetically manipulated plants will mix with other plants with potentially devastating consequences. He says, quote, "Everybody knows that, and we have no idea what's going to happen. Should the gene be one that confers resistance to insects, suddenly we have no insects. With no insects, you have no ecology, no ecosystem, no pollinators, no flowers, God knows what." Surely in the face of such catastrophic risk, we must demand a deeper and more considered inquiry. In moments of candor, the gene giants themselves admit that they do not know what the consequences of their behavior will be. Last December, Dr. Michael Phillips, Executive Director for Food and Agriculture at BIO, this is the trade association representing biotech companies, and he said that he concurred with a Science magazine study calling for further research into the ecological risk of transgenic crops, but said that certainly the public should not look to the biotech industry to foot the bill. Imagine. The dilemmas caused by science and technology have always been part of human experience. These emerging technologies, however, have an unprecedented capacity to rapidly transform our lives and strain our ability to respond in ways that can protect and strengthen democratic society. This is due to a variety of factors. The new science and technology advances synergistically, multiplying the rate and magnitude of both technological change and societal transformation. Access to advanced technologies proliferates, and the production of novel, transforming, self-proliferating technologies, self-replicating technologies, is becoming routine. The culture of discovery and innovation is changing as private funding displaces public research investments, patent protection expands to emerging types of research findings, and ownership of knowledge becomes a critical issue in the global marketplace. And government regulatory systems for safeguarding the public are unable to keep pace with the changes created by emerging knowledge and innovation. While it may be impossible to predict with much accuracy what the large-scale and long-term consequences of the biotech, robotics, nanotech revolution will be, it's incumbent upon those of us concerned about the fate of the planet, with finding meaning in our lives, and with the future of civil society to consider how to govern them. We must examine the conflict between democratic control of science and the legitimate need for freedom of inquiry. Further, we need to create a compelling rationale, language, and framework for an expanded public discourse over the question of moral and political governance of science and technology in civil society. We're going to begin with Maewon Ho. Maewon holds a PhD in biochemistry. In the past 15 years, she's pioneered research into the physics of organisms and sustainable systems. Since 1994, she's been scientific advisor to the Third World Network and has engaged in debates and discussions in 30 countries around the world with frequent appearances in the media. She's currently director of the Institute of Science in Society, which she co-founded in 1999, as well as visiting professor of biophysics at Catania University. Maewon has authored more than 250 publications, including 10 books spanning several disciplines. They include genetic engineering, dream or nightmare, and turning the tide on the brave new world of bad science and big business. Mae Wan Ho.
Thank you very much, IFG, for inviting me here. I don't want to spread gloom and doom. I will try not to. Now, the year 2001 has already been very eventful, not quite as Arthur Clarke envisaged, but significant all the same. And I just want to pick out three events. The first was headline in the New Scientist magazine on 13th of January. A deadly virus was created accidentally by researchers in Australia who were trying to genetic engineer a relatively harmless mousepox as a contraceptive vaccine for mice. And they created a deadly virus. And this virus was so deadly, it killed all the mice that the researchers injected into. And mousepox virus is related to the human smallpox virus. So the incident raised the specter of biological warfare. And alarm rang recently again when scientists announced that someone was going to make the first artificial virus, just to show it could be done. But the far greater danger is in the unintentional creation of deadly pathogens in the course of apparently innocent genetic engineering experiments. Well, genetic engineering involves facilitating horizontal gene transfer across species barriers. And it also involves rampant recombination of genetic material that are from many, many different species and their parasites, viruses and bacteria and so on. And, you know, this may already be happening over the past 25 years of gene biotechnology in both agriculture and medicine. Genetic engineering uses the same tools and makes similar genetic engineered constructs, whether it is in agriculture or in medicine, and they pose the same risks. And don't forget, disease epidemics too are globalized. The accompanying New Scientist editorial remarked that 5 years ago, when biomedical researchers were asked if genetic engineering could create a virus or bacteria more virulent than nature's worst, the researchers said, well, it would be difficult, if not impossible. Some of us have been warning of accidents such as this for at least the past 6 years. I co-authored a detailed review with six colleagues on the evidence suggesting links between gene genetic engineering and the recent resurgence of drug and antibiotic-resistant viruses and bacteria, which are causing epidemics of infectious diseases across the globe. This was published in a scientific journal in 1998. We were by no means the first. In fact, the scientists who pioneered genetic engineering declared a moratorium in Asilomar in the mid-1970s precisely because they were worried about this dire possibility. Unfortunately, overwhelming pressure for commercial exploitation cut the moratorium short. The scientists set up guidelines based largely on assumptions, all of which have fallen by the wayside as a result of new scientific findings. Instead of tightening the guidelines, our regulators have relaxed them as commercial pressures built up. Transgenic waste, not only toxic sludge, are being recycled as food, feed, fertilizer, and landfills. Genetic engineering has unleashed an uncontrollable, self-amplifying process of horizontal gene transfer and recombination that can sweep across the living world, with potential, indeed, of creating viruses and bacteria more virulent than nature's worst. It is time we call a halt to all releases of GMOs and to make sure that further research takes place only under strictly contained conditions. Now, the second significant event is the vote in the UK House of Lords, 22nd of January, allowing research on human so-called therapeutic cloning to go ahead. This means they can now create a human embryo by the process that made Dolly the cloned sheep, by transferring the nucleus of an adult cell, human cell, into an egg emptied of its nucleus. The egg is then stimulated to divide and develop into an embryo, up to 14 days, so that embryonic stem cells can be harvested for cell and tissue replacement therapy. The embryo being destroyed or sacrificed in the process. This was a grave mistake, both morally and scientifically, because adult stem cells, which can be obtained relatively easily from patients requiring transplant, are already showing far greater promise and much less risk than any embryonic stem cells. The only reason for the research is that embryonic stem cells can be patented and sold. And this says volumes on the extent to which science has been corrupted. Nuclear transplant cloning, by the way, is very crude and ineffective. It would take at least 50 women to provide enough empty eggs. Adverts for selling and buying human eggs have already appeared on the internet. It is time we revoked and banned all patents on life. But there is a much more serious issue here. Biotechnology is threatening our entire way of life, our survival, the survival of the planet, and the most basic moral values of being human. Patenting of life has accelerated to a frenzy. Companies are patenting not just genes and cell lines, but DNA databases of entire populations. And our governments are obligingly spending our public money, huge sums of it, to build up such databases. Eugenics and genetic discrimination have come back, as you will hear, along with the invasion of privacy. Terrible suffering is being inflicted on animals. Genetic engineered pigs to provide spare organs for transplant when all the indications are that it would create pandemics of pig viruses crossing into human populations. That also should be banned. Animals are turned into bioreactors to supply pharmaceuticals and industrial fibers in their milk, blood, urine, and semen. Companies are even creating so-called human clones by transferring the nucleus of human cells into empty eggs of cow and pig. All this abuse stems from the discredited mechanistic paradigm that still dominates Western science and the global society at large. Mary Shelley's brilliant novel, Frankenstein, was not just a parable of the arrogant scientist playing God. It is also about mechanistic science out of control in the pursuit of corporate profit. The irony is that contemporary Western science across the disciplines is rediscovering how nature is organic, dynamic, and interconnected. There are no linear causal chains linking genes to the characteristics of organisms, let alone the human condition, as the genetic determinists would have us believe. The discredited paradigm is perpetrated by a scientific establishment consciously or unconsciously serving the corporate agenda and making even the most unethical applications seem compelling. And this brings me to the third event the announcement of the complete human map, genome map, which, according to the prime genome sequencer, Craig Venter, spells the death of genetic determinism at last. The Book of Life, so-called, turns out to have at most 30,000 genes, far too few to support the extravagant claims throughout the past decade that individual genes not only determine how our bodies are constructed, what diseases we suffer from, but also our patterns of behavior, our intellectual ability, sexual preference, criminality, and so on. He said, "We simply do not have enough genes for the idea of biological determinism to be right. The wonderful diversity of human species is not hardwired in our genetic code. Our environments are critical. Now that the bubble has burst, it is time for us to move on. Let me emphasize that we have all the sciences and technologies to save the world. What we lack is the will and conviction. I want to spend a few minutes, therefore, talking about the difference it makes to seeing nature as organism as opposed to machine. Let's start from genetics. The genetic determinist mindset has ruled biology and the popular culture at large before genetic engineering got underway 25 years ago. It has no concept of the organism as a whole, nor of societies, nor of ecosystems. Instead, it sees only selfish individuals, each competing against all, and all at war with nature. This fits hand in glove with a neoliberal economic theory that is driving and validating globalization. The organism is presented as little more than a collection of traits tied to specific genes that are supposed to be passed on unchanged to the next generation, rather like gold dust. That's why they bank them in gene banks. And if that were the case, genetic engineering would be as precise and effective as is claimed. This view became increasingly untenable as researchers began to reveal an immense amount of crosstalk between genes. Genes work in complex and tangled networks. They are nothing if not dynamic, sensitive, and responsive to other genes, to the cell or organism in which they find themselves, and to the external environment. Genes are active or not depending on the environment. Furthermore, they mutate, multiply, rearrange, and jump around. Genes from one organism can even jump into the genome of another one. That's called horizontal gene transfer, the process that is enhanced and exploited in genetic engineering. The genetic material is so flexible and mutable that by the 1980s, geneticists were inspired to coin the phrase, the fluid genome. Genetics has indeed changed out of all recognition as gene biotechnology got underway, and that's unfortunate. The transition between classical genetics and new genetics is like the transition between classical physics and quantum physics. And that is why genetic engineering, at least in its current form, can never succeed. It is based on misconceptions that organisms are machines and on a denial of the complexity, flexibility, and sensitivity of the organic whole. Now, sweep away the debris of the human genome fanfare and appreciate the real wonders of the organism. Just when biologists have made up their mind that life is downhill from the moment of birth, just when they were so sure that the different kinds of cells in our body are fixed for the rest of their lives and can only replace themselves and eventually die, they are in for a surprise. Stem cells, cells that retain the ability to become many different kinds of cells in the body, is the greatest recent discovery in biology. These cells are present not only at the beginning of development in embryology, but also throughout adult life. Findings are tumbling out of laboratories every week on the remarkable flexibility and potential of stem cells that can easily be isolated from adults, such as cells in the bone marrow. These can regenerate practically all the cell types found in the body, according to the context in which they find themselves. Parallel discoveries are made in ecology, as you heard in the previous section, so I won't repeat that. But what I would say is that population arguments are based on the concept of carrying capacity of ecosystems. That is the maximum number of individuals that it can support. Now, that is actually a fallacy, because the carrying capacity is not a fixed physical constant. Evidence is emerging that the more biodiverse a system, the greater the carrying capacity and hence the productivity. And so biodiverse systems are also more stable and resilient and therefore offer greater food security. And in short, academic ecologists are rediscovering the indigenous wisdom of traditional cultures around the world. Agricultural ecology is working wonders around the world. And what I'm making a plea is that scientists who are working in the West should learn from our scientists in indigenous cultures and work with them. And that's how we can bring about this paradigm change to an organic way of living instead of this mechanistic nightmare. Thank you very much.
That was the biochemist, geneticist, and neuroscientist Mei Wan Ho. She's visiting professor of biophysics in Catania University and has pioneered research into the physics of organisms and sustainable systems. She's the author of 10 books, including Genetic Engineering, Dream or Nightmare, and The Rainbow and the Worm, The Physics of Organisms. She spoke on the panel on Remaking the Nature of Nature at the Teach-In on Technology and Globalization, organized by the International Forum on Globalization in early 2001. Next week's speakers are Arpad Pushtai and Pat Roy Mooney. I hope you have a pen handy for more information. You can find links to the websites of the organizations mentioned today on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under newest programs. You can get a copy of today's program on Remaking the Nature of Nature with Chris Desser and Mei Wan Ho for $12. That includes shipping. TUC Radio is listener-supported and free to all radio stations. Your tape order helps us stay on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to order. You can get your tape by mail or credit card, by phone or on the web. Our toll-free phone number, 877-TUC-TAPE, translates into 877-882-8273. My name is Mariah Gilardin. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.